personal. The Tantra Vision, Volume 2. Talks on the Royal Song of Saraha, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse Number 6.
The first question. The question is very similar. What happens to my wife when you speak to me? What is the game? When you are really in communion with me, you cannot speak. When you are really listening to me, you will lose your voice. Because in that moment, I am your voice. The communion that happens between me and you is not between two persons. It is not a discussion. It is not a debate. It is not an argument. It is not even a dialogue. The communion happens only when you are lost, when you are not there. At the highest peak, it is not even I-thou relationship. It is not relationship at all. I am not. And there comes a moment to you also when you are not. In that moment, two zeros disappear into each other. That's why, Sumindra, whenever you come to me, you lose your voice. And it is not happening only to you, it is happening to all those who are really coming closer to me. How can you come closer to me and still keep your voice? How you can be near me and still be yourself? Your voice is the voice of you. When the you starts disappearing, naturally the voice also starts disappearing. Secondly, there is nothing to say. When you are in love with me, you know that if there is something to say, I will know. And if I don't know it, then it is not worth saying. Then it is not needed. Then it must be some irrelevant, vagrant thought. It has no need to be uttered even. It will be a sheer wastage of energy. The mind goes on catching 1,001 thoughts from everywhere, from all sources. All your thoughts are not yours. Thoughts go on jumping from one head into other, even without talking, even without conveying. Continuously thoughts are jumping from one head to another head. You catch hold of them. And if for a moment you are possessed by the thought and you think it is something essential, when you come to me, suddenly those thoughts that you have caught from others disappear. It happens to many sannyasins. They come ready with many questions, and then just sitting in front of me, they are at a loss. Those questions have disappeared. It is significantly meaningful. It shows those questions were not yours. they were not truly yours. When you are in front of me, really in front of me, when you are looking at me, that which is essential only will be left. The non-essential will go. Sometimes your all thoughts can disappear. Not only that you lose your voice, you lose your mind too. And that is the only way to be around a master. Go on losing your mind. Hang loose, relaxed, untense. There is nothing to say. There is much to listen, but there is nothing to say. And then, thirdly, everything is going so good with Sumindra. We only say things when things are not going good. I have heard a mother complained to several doctors of her 7-year-old failure to speak. Examinations yielded the fact that he was a remarkably healthy child, and she was told not to worry, but worry she did. One day in a hurry, she burned his oatmeal, but served it anyway. He tasted it, spat it out, and said, "God, this stuff is awful. You must have burnt it." Delighted, she said, "You are talking. Why have not you said anything before this?" He looked at her with some disdain and said, "Well, everything has been all right up to now. And everything has been all right up to now with Sumindra. There is nothing to say." The second question. While in an art museum in Frankfurt recently, I entered one room with nothing but statues and carvings of Buddha. I put absolutely no faith in stone idols, but I was surprised to feel a very strong energy current in the room, similar to what I feel in the lecture here. Was I imagining things? And if so, how can I trust what I feel here with you? The question is from Anand Samagra. The first thing to be understood, the Buddha statues has nothing to do with Gautam Buddha. You will be surprised to know. They are all false. They don't resemble Buddha at all. But they have to do something with Buddhahood, not with Gautam Buddha, the person. They have something to do with Buddhahood. You can go in a Jaina temple and you will see 24 statues of 24 Tirthankaras, the founders of Jainism, and you will be unable to make any difference between them. They are all alike. To make a distinction, Jainas make small symbols on them to know who is who, because they are all alike. So somebody's symbol is a lion figure. So just underneath the feet there is a small lion figure. Then they know whose statue is this. Somebody's symbol is a snake. Then they know whose statue is this. If those symbols are hidden, not even a Jaina can make any demarcation. Whose statue is this? Mahavira's? Parsvanatha's? Adinatha's? And you will also be surprised, they are exactly like Buddha. No difference. In the beginning, when the West became acquainted with Mahavira, they thought it is nothing but the same story of Buddha, because the statue is the same. The philosophy is the same. The understanding is the same. The teaching is the same. So it is just the same thing. It is nothing different from Buddha. They thought Mahavira is another name for Buddha. And of course both were called Buddhas. Buddha means the awakened one, so Mahavira was also called Buddha. And Buddha was called Buddha. And both were called Jinas. Jina means the conqueror, one who has conquered himself. Buddha is called the Jina, and Mahavira is called the Jina. So they thought they are just the same person. And the statue was a great proof. They look absolutely alike. They are not photographic. They don't represent a person. They represent a certain state. And you will have to understand it, then the thing will be explained. In India, three words are very important. One is tantra, we are talking about. Another is mantra. And third is yantra. Tantra means techniques of expanding your consciousness. Mantra means finding your inner sounds, your inner rhythm, your inner vibration. Once you have found your mantra, it is of tremendous help. Just one utterance of the mantra and you are in a totally different world. That becomes the key, the passage. Because once uttering that mantra, you fall into your natural vibe. And the third is yantra. These statues are yantras. Yantra means a certain figure which can create a certain state in you. A certain figure, if you look at it, is bound to create a certain state in you. Have you not watched, looking at a Picasso painting, you will start feeling a little uneasy. Concentrate on a Picasso painting for half an hour, and you will feel very bizarre, something going crazy. You cannot watch a Picasso painting for half an hour. If you keep Picasso paintings in your bedroom, you will have nightmares. You will have very dangerous dreams, being haunted by ghosts, tortured by Adolf Hitler and things like that. A war victim in a concentration camp, things like that. When you watch something, it is not only that the figure is outside, when you watch something, the figure creates a certain situation in you. Gurdjieff used to call this objective art. And you know it. Listening to modern pop music, something happens in you, you become more sexually excited. There is nothing but sound outside, but the sound hits inside, creates something in you. Listening to classical music, you become less sexual, less excited. In fact, with great classical music, you almost forget sex. You are in a tranquility, a silence, a totally different dimension of your being. You exist on another plane. Watching a Buddha statue is watching a yantra. The figure of the statue, the geometry of the statue, creates a figure inside you. And that inside figure creates a certain vibe. It was not just imagination that happened to you, Samagra, in Frankfurt Museum. Those Buddha statues created a certain vibe in you. Watch the statue of Buddha sitting so silently in a certain yoga posture. If you go on watching the statue, you will find something like that is happening within you too. If you are in a company where 10 persons are sad and you are the 11th person, how long you can remain happy? Those 10 persons will function like a yantra of sadness. You will fall into sadness sooner or later. If you are unhappy and you go in a company where people are joking and laughing, how long you can remain sad? Those laughing people will create laughter in you. They will change your focus. They will change your gear. You will start moving in a different direction. This happens every day, knowingly, unknowingly. When you watch a full moon, what happens to you? Or when you listen to the birds and look at the green trees, what happens to you? When you go in a forest and look at the greenery, what happens to you? Something green inside you starts happening. The green is the color of nature. The green is the color of spontaneity. The green is the color of life. Something green starts happening in you. The outer color reflects something inside, vibrates something inside, creates something inside. Looking at a green tree, you become more alive, you become younger. When you go to the Himalayas and you see the mountains, snow-capped mountains, eternal snow, which has never melted. Purest snow where no man has ever walked. Uncontaminated by human society and human touch. When you look at a Himalayan peak, that uncorrupted, virgin snow creates something virgin in you. A subtle peace starts happening inside. The outer is not the outer and the inner is not just the inner. They are joined together. So beware what you see. Beware what you listen. Beware what you read. Beware where you go. Because that all creates you. That's what happened in Frankfurt. The Buddha statue and many statues all around you created a certain geometry. You will be surprised. That is the basic reason why statues were created. They are not idols as you think. The Christian and the Mohammedan and the Judaic idea has given a very wrong notion to the world. They are not idols. They are very scientific. They are not objects to be worshipped. They are geometries to be imbibed. It is a totally different thing. In China, there is one Buddha temple which has 10,000 Buddha statues, all Buddha statues. Wherever you look, the same figures. The ceiling has the same figures. All sides have the same figure. The walls have the same figure. 10,000 Buddha statues. Just think, sitting cross-legged in a Buddha posture, you also surrounded by 10,000 Buddhas. It creates a geometry. From everywhere, Buddha impinges upon you. From every nook and corner, he starts surrounding you. You are gone. Your ordinary geometry is no more there. Your ordinary life is no more there. For a few moments, you are moving on higher planes, on higher altitudes. That's what is happening here. While listening to me, something is created by my presence, by my words, by your attitudes, by so many orange people around you. It is a situation. It is a temple. A temple is a situation. It is not just that you are sitting in a lecture hall. So many people with such love, gratitude, listening to me, with such silence, with such sympathy, with such repose. This place becomes holy. This place becomes a tirtha. It is sacred. When you come into this place, you are riding on a wave. You need not make much effort. You can simply allow it to happen. You will be taken away, far away, to the other source. A marriage broker arranged with a family to bring over a girl he thought would be a fine match for their son. After dinner, the girl left and the family began to attack the marriage broker. What kind of a girl did you bring? A monster? One eye in the middle of her forehead? The left ear way up here? The right ear way down there, and the chin way back? The marriage broker interrupted, "Look, either you like Picasso or you don't. The modern painting represents the ugly in existence. The ugly has become predominant for a certain reason. This century is one of the ugliest century. Two world wars within 50 years, millions of people killed, destroyed. Such cruelty, such aggression, such violence, such madness. This century is a nightmarish century. Man has lost track of his humanity. What man has been doing to man? Naturally, this madness has erupted everywhere in the painting, in the music, in sculpture, in architecture, everywhere. The ugly human mind has created ugliness. Ugliness has become an aesthetic value. Now the photographer goes and looks for something ugly. Not that the beauty has stopped existing, it exists as much as before, but it is neglected. The cactus has replaced the rose. Not that cactus is something new, it has existed always. But this century has come to know that thorns seem to be more real than a rose flower. A rose flower seems to be a dream. It does not fit with us. Hence, rose flower has been expelled. In your drawing room has entered the cactus. Just 100 years before, nobody would have ever thought to bring a cactus home. Now, if you are modern, your garden will be full of cactuses. Rose looks a little bourgeois. Rose looks a little out of date. Rose looks tarry, orthodox, traditional. The cactus looks revolutionary. Yes, the cactus is revolutionary, like Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin and Mao Zedong and Fidel Castro. Yes. Cactus seems to be closer to this century. The photographer looks for some ugly thing. He will go and photograph a beggar. Not that beggar has not existed before. It has existed before. It is real, certainly real. But nobody has been making art out of it. We were feeling humble before the beggars. We were feeling apologized before the beggars. We were feeling something which should not be is still there. We wanted the beggars not to be there. But this century goes on searching for the ugly. Still, the sun penetrates the pines in a certain morning. The rays penetrating the pines create such a web of beauty. It still exists, but no photographer is interested. That no more appeals. Ugliness appeals because we have become ugly. That which appeals us shows something about us. Buddha is a rose flower. That is the highest possibility. And remember, it is not exactly Buddha figures. Nobody knows how Buddha looked like. But that is not the point. We were not interested in those days, not at least in the East, we were not interested at all in the real. We were interested in the ultimately real. We were not interested in the factual. We were interested in the truth itself. Maybe Buddha had a little longer nose. But if the artist thought that a little smaller nose will be more in tune with meditation. Then he had dropped that long nose of Buddha. He has made it a little smaller. Maybe Buddha had a big belly. Who knows? Japanese Buddhas have. Japanese Buddha statues have big bellies. But Indian Buddhas don't have big bellies. Different attitudes. In Japan, they think a meditator has to breathe from the belly, from the navel. And when you breathe from the belly of course becomes a little bigger. Then the chest is not so protruding as the belly. The chest is relaxed. So Japanese Buddhas have big bellies. That too is for a certain reason. To indicate you that belly breathing is the right breathing. It has nothing to do with Buddha. Nobody knows whether he had a big belly or not. The Indian statues don't have big bellies. Because the Indian yoga does not insist on belly breathing. The belly has to be in. That too has a certain different reason. If you want the sexual energy to move upwards, then it is better not to belly breathe. When the belly is pulled in, the energy is sucked upwards more easily. Different techniques. Belly breathing is also good for a certain meditator. It is very relaxing. But then the energy cannot move in the same way as it moves when the belly is pulled in. The Indian statues of Buddha have small bellies, almost no bellies. Nobody knows how Buddha looked exactly. The statues are very feminine, very round. They don't look masculine. Have you ever seen any statue with mustache and beard? No. The people who painted Jesus were more realists. The people who painted Buddha were not concerned with facticity. They were concerned with ultimate truth. They were not concerned how Buddha looks. They were concerned how Buddha should look. The emphasis was not on Buddha, but on the people who will be watching these statues. How this statue is going to help those people. So Buddha is not painted as old. He must have become old. He became 82. He was very old. Certainly very old and ill. A physician has to follow him continuously. But no statue has painted him as old, ill. Because that is not the point. We are not interested in the physical body of the Buddha. We are interested in his inner geometry. That inner quality of Buddha is always young. It is never old. And it is never ill. It is always a state of well-being. By its very nature, it cannot be ill. The body is young, the body is old, the body becomes crippled, the body dies. Buddha is not born, never dies. Buddha remains eternally young. Watching a young statue, something of youth will happen in you, and you will feel something fresh. Now, Indians would have never preferred Jesus being pictured, painted, sculptured on the cross. It is ugly. It is sad. Even if it is historical, it is not worth remembering. Because whatsoever you think has happened, you tend to help it happen again. There is no obligation towards facts. We don't owe anything to the past. We need not remember the past as it was. It is in our hands to choose the past, to choose the past in such a way so that a better future can be created. Yes, Jesus was crucified, but if he was crucified in India, we would not have painted that. Even on the cross, we would have painted a totally different thing. The Western painting of Jesus is in anguish, in sadness. Naturally, he is being killed. When you watch, when you concentrate, meditate on Jesus, you will feel sad. It is not accidental that Christians say Jesus never laughed. And it is not accidental that you are not allowed to dance and laugh and be gay in a church. Church is a serious affair. You have to be very serious, long faces. In fact, where Jesus is crucified, just on the altar, how can you laugh and sing? In India, you can sing and laugh and enjoy. Religion is a merriment, a celebration. The whole point is, the Western mind is historical, the Eastern mind is existential. The West pays too much attention to mundane facts. The East never pays any attention to history. You will be surprised to know that until Western people came to India, India had not known anything like history. We have never been writing history. We have never bothered about it. That's why we don't know when Buddha exactly was born, when exactly he died. We have never paid much respect to facts. Facts are mundane. What does it matter whether he was born on Monday or Tuesday or Thursday? What does it matter? How does it matter? In fact, it does not matter at all. Any day will do, and any year will do. That is not the point. The point is, who was born? Who was this man in his innermost course? History thinks about the periphery. Myth thinks about the innermost core. India has written mythology, but not history. We have Puranas. Puranas are mythologies. They are not histories. They are poetic, mystic visions of how things should be, not how they are. They are the vision of the ultimate. And Buddha is the vision of ultimate samadhi. Those Buddha statues you saw in the Frankfurt Museum are the states of inner silence. When a person is absolutely silent, he will be in that state. When everything is still and quiet and calm inside, not a thought moves, not a small breeze blows. When everything has stopped, time has stopped, then you will also feel like sitting like a Buddha. Something of the same geometry will happen to you. It is objective art. Less concerned with the reality of Buddha, more concerned of those people who will be coming and will be seeking Buddhahood. The emphasis is different. Those who will watch these statues and will kneel down before these statues and will meditate on these statues, what will happen to them? In India, there are temples like Khajuraho, where all sorts of sexual postures are sculptured. Many postures are such absurd that even a disade or masoj will not be able to imagine them. The most pervert person also cannot imagine. For example, the man and woman standing on their head and making love does not seem that anybody is going to try or imagine. Why they painted these pictures? They are examples of objective art. These temples of Khajuraho were no ordinary temples. They were a kind of therapy. They exist like a therapy. Whenever somebody was suffering from some sexual perversion, he was to be sent to Khajuraho. He had to watch and meditate on all those abnormal, bizarre things. He had something pervert in his mind. That perversion is inside the unconscious. What psychoanalysis is doing, it tries to bring from the unconscious to the conscious, that's all. And psychoanalysis says, once something comes from the unconscious to the conscious, it is released, you are free of it. Now this was a great psychoanalysis, this Khajuraho. An abnormally perverted man is brought. He has repressed his perversions. Sometimes they erupt, but he goes on repressing. He knows that something is there like a wound, but he has never been able to see it face to face. He is brought to Khajuraho. He moves slowly, meditating on each statue, each bizarre posture. And one day suddenly, one posture fits with his inner perversion. Suddenly, from the unconscious, the perversion surfaces to the conscious, and it is released. Without any Freud or Jung or Adler there, just the temple will do. He is left in the temple. For a few weeks he can be there. For each meditator who really wanted to go into deep meditation, it was good to visit a temple like Khajuraho in those days. On the walls of the temple are all these statues. Very abnormal, very crazy, very perverse. Inside the temple there is no sexual painting, no sexual statue at all. No sexuality at all. Inside is either Buddha's statue, or Shiva's statue, or Krishna's statue. What is the meaning of it? Why just outside on the walls sex and inside no sex? It was a technique. First, you have to move on the periphery so that you can become free of sex. When a person feels that now these sexual statues don't attract him at all, now he goes on sitting before them and nothing happens inside him. He remains calm and quiet. No sexual arousal. No excitement. For weeks he waits and no sexuality is felt. Then he is capable to enter the temple. It is symbolic. nor his sexuality can go beyond. These temples were Tantra temples, one of the greatest experiments ever done. They are not obscene. They are not pornographic. They are spiritual. Great experiment in spirituality. Great experiment in transforming human energy towards higher levels. But first the energy has to be freed from the lower level. And to free it, there is only one way, to make it absolutely conscious. To bring all the fantasies of the unconscious mind to the conscious. When the unconscious is completely unburdened, you are free. Then you don't have any blocks. Then you can move inwards. Then you can go inside the temple. Then you can meditate on Buddha, on Shiva or Krishna. It was not imagination, samagra. It was object to art you stumbled upon unknowingly. The third question, what do you have that I have not got? And I am not talking about ashram and car and secretary and all that stuff. You must be talking about all that stuff. Otherwise, why do you mention it at all? The very mentioning sows the mind. You must have been afraid. The idea must have crossed your mind. And I don't have any ashram. And I don't have any car and I don't have any secretary. In fact, I don't have anything. Having is not the thing, being. I am just here. Being is my wealth, not having. If the ashram is here, it is for you, not for me. If the secretary is here, it is for you, not for me. All that exists here is for you. It does not, it has not anything to do with me. I am enough alone. But somewhere deep in your mind, you must be too much attached with things. When you formulate a question, remember, it shows much about you. A question is not only a question, it is very symbolic also. Several men in the smoking room were arguing as to who was the greatest inventor. One contended for Stephenson, who invented the railroads. Another for Edison. Another for Marconi. Still another for Wright brothers. Finally, one of them turned to a small man who had been listening but who had said nothing. "What do you think, Mr. Mann?" "Well," came the reply with a knowing smile, "the man who invented interest was nobody's fool." And the Jew is hidden in everybody. And the Jew goes on thinking only of money, interest, things, having. First thing, change your focus from having to being. You can have the whole world, and it is not going to help, and you will remain a beggar. And I am not saying renounce the world, mind you. I am not saying renounce the world. Don't jump to the opposite conclusion. I am saying you can have the whole world and you will not have anything. That's all I am saying. I am not saying renounce it. Because those who renounce, their mind also remains focused on having. You count money, they also count money. You say, "I have got that many thousand dollars," they say, "I have renounced that many thousand dollars." But the counting continues. You are a bookkeeper and they are also bookkeepers. And bookkeeping is the world. To know who you are is to become an emperor. To be is to be an emperor. To have is to be poor. There are two kinds of poor men in the world, those who have and those who have not. But both are poor. Because those who have, they have nothing. And those who have not, of course, they have not got anything. Both are poor. Those who don't have, they think continuously of having. And those who have, they are puzzled what to do with it now. They are stuck with it. They have wasted their whole life in having it. Now it is there. And they don't know what to do with it. It has not satisfied anything. It has not brought any fulfillment. It has not brought any flowering. They have not come to celebrate life yet. God has not happened through it. It never happens through having. You ask, "What do you have that I have not got?" If you insist in terms of having, then you have got more, much more than I have got. You have got infinitely more. Greed, anger, lust, ambition, ego, and thousand and one things. What I have got? Just nothing. Exactly just nothing. If you think from the point of having, I am the poorest man. Because I have got just nothing. But if you think from the point of being, I am the richest man. Because once you drop ego, you don't lose anything. You only lose a disease. When you drop greed, you don't lose anything. You only lose a disease. When you drop anger, you don't lose anything. You gain. Each time you drop things like this which you have, the richer you become. When greed disappears, there comes into existence sharing. When anger disappears, there comes into existence compassion. When hate, jealousy, possessiveness disappear, there comes into being love. I have got only myself. But that self expresses itself in many, many dimensions, in sharing, in love, in compassion. So, I can say you have more, much more, and yet I will say you are not yet. I am, and you are not. The fourth question: what do you mean when you say that man is a machine? That man is a machine. Three scenes. First, hello Bernie, old pal, greeted Charlie, somewhat parted. Let us go into a bar and celebrate the cigar habit. What are you talking about? Asked Bernie. Listen, Charlie went on, my wife wanted me to stop smoking, and her system is, when I feel like a cigar, to get an O. Henry candy bar instead. Did you do that? Bernie inquired. Yeah. And that's why I'm celebrating. I'm back on cigars. That candy bar idea does not work. Believe me, I tried it. Every time I wanted a cigar, I bought an O. Bernie, O. Henry candy bar. But you want to know something? I could not keep it lit. When I say man is a machine, I mean man functions through habits, not through awareness. When I say man is a machine, I mean man functions through his past, not through his spontaneity. The second scene. A night worker had let his whiskers grow until his favorite baseball team won the pennant, much to the disgust of his young and pretty wife. On the day his team clinched the pennant, he laid off work, got himself a shave, went home early, and slipped into bed. He took his wife's hand in the darkness and placed it upon his smoothly shaven face. She turned slightly while running her fingers over the now smooth chin and said, make it snappy, kid. Old whiskers will be home any minute now. When I say man is a machine, I mean man does not see what is the case. Man does not look into the present moment. Man is not responsive to the reality. Man goes on living into old ideas. Man lives through habits. The third scene. One day Mullah Nasruddin read in a magazine, a small poetry. He loved it. The poetry is, "Sir, why not buy a bunch or two of springtime flowers fair and take them home one cheerless day, but carry them with care. Just hand them to your wife and say, I thought of you in town today." Mulla Nasruddin exactly did this. He bought some flowers, but instead of entering the house as usual, he knocked, and when his wife opened the door, he just handed them to her. To his great surprise, she burst out crying. "Why, whatever is the matter?" he asked. "Ah," she replied, "I have had an awful day. I have broke the teapot, the baby has been crying, the cook has left, and now you come home drunk." That's what I mean when I say man is a machine. And you don't become aware of it, because how a machine can become aware? You need somebody to hammer on your head continuously with the hope that sometime the hammer will really hit you, shock you out of your habits, and for a moment you will be awake. That's the whole purpose of a master. To go on hitting you from this side, from that side, from all the sides, and go on changing techniques, situations, devices. So someday you are caught unawares. Even for a single moment, if you become aware, you will know that your whole past has been a mechanical past. But you will know only then, not by my saying it, that man is a machine. You will know only then, when you have tasted one moment of awareness, then your whole life will be simply known, seen, recognized as mechanical. Because even to know that it has been mechanical, you need something to compare with. You don't have anything to compare with. And you live amongst machines. Your father is a machine, your mother is a machine, your wife is a machine, your friends, your boss, you live amongst machines, you are a machine. How to become aware? Once Mulla Nasruddin's wife told me that she was never aware that her husband was drinking until he came home sober one night. If a man is continuously drinking, it is very difficult to know that he is drinking. You become accustomed of seeing him in that way. You are a machine. It hurts. That's the purpose of calling you a machine. Let it hurt. If it doesn't hurt, then you are incurable. If it hurts, then there is possibility. If it hurts, it means somehow, deep down in the unconscious, you also feel that, yes, it is so. Do you live in the present moment? Do you recognize things as they are right now? Are you just to go on seeing them through old eyes, old mind, memory? Don't you have glitches? You immediately put things into certain boxes, ready-made boxes. For example, if you are a Hindu and you meet a man and you were very much interested in the man and the man was looking beautiful, and was very nice, and you liked his wife, and then you ask things about him, and he says, I am a Mohammedan, and finished. All that nice wife is no more there. You have shrunken back. You have a box, fixed box, that Mohammedans are not good. You are a Hindu. Mohammedans are bad. You immediately categorize him. You pigeonhole him. Now you are no more interested in the reality of the man. The reality was saying something else. But it was going against your pet categories and theories. I have heard a young woman went to the town, to the big town nearby, to work there. They were very poor, and the mother was old, and that was the only child, that young woman, and she had gone to work and to earn some money. After a few months he came back really with lots of money. The mother was very happy. She asked, so now tell me, what do you do there? And the daughter was really honest. She said, I have become a prostitute. What? The mother screamed and fainted. When she came back after half an hour, she again asked, tell me again what you have become. And she said, I told you, mother, that I have become a prostitute. The mother said, thank God. I thought you said you have become a Protestant. They were Catholics, of course. Categorization goes on continuously in the mind. Watch. When you do something, do you respond to the fact here now? Or you follow certain bad theories? When you do something, do you do it with attention, awareness? Or you just do like a robot? I talked the other day about three awarenesses. Awareness one, awareness two, awareness three. This is the first awareness, to watch yourself, to watch your actions, to watch your reactions, to watch your responses, how you are behaving as a man or as a machine. And out of 100, 99 times you will find you are behaving like a machine. But if you start becoming a little alert, then you are becoming something more than a machine. The plus point is arising in you. That awareness will help you to become man. Only when you are aware, you are man. Fully aware, you are fully man. Fully unaware, you are a machine. The fifth question. Since I have been here, everything I have wished for has happened for me. Now I have all I could possibly want, and I feel like my heart is breaking. What is happening? You have misunderstood. The heart is breaking out of joy. The heart is breaking out of delight. Sheer delight. Joy becomes in a moment unbearable. When joy is unbearable, then really you are joyful. Then joy is at the pinnacles. Then joy is at the 100 degrees. If you can bear this much joy, sooner or later you will start evaporating through this joy. You will start disappearing into divine. Don't be afraid. Nothing wrong is happening to you. You are blessed. But it happens, our ideas. If you see somebody crying, you think that person is sad, must be in misery. You start consoling. Have you heard the expression tears of joy? There are tears of joy too. So don't be in a hurry to console. Maybe he is just being joyful. But we know only people crying when they are unhappy. We don't know people crying when they are happy because people are not happy at all. So tears of joy are only in poetries, found in poetries, not in eyes. But tears have nothing to do with sadness. It is an ugly state of humanity, a sad state of affairs, that men cry and weep only when they are sad. Miserable. Joys have, tears have nothing to do with misery as such. Tears come only when something is overflowing. It may be sadness, it may be joy, it may be love, it may be anger. You can watch women when they become too angry, they start crying. It is anger, not sadness. You watch a small child. If he laughs too much, he starts crying. It is too much, unbearable. He starts overflowing in tears. Tears are just an indication that the cup is overfull. They start overflowing. You say, since I have been here, everything I have wished for has happened for me. That's why the joy is becoming unbearable. You are coming closer home. Now I have all I could possibly want, and I feel like my heart is breaking. What is happening? The question is from Anand Pratima. Something tremendously beautiful is happening. Don't try to analyze it, and don't try to think about it. Don't try to interpret it. Otherwise the mind can destroy the whole thing. It is mind trying to interfere with the heart. This question is from the mind. The heart is overfull of joy. That's why it is breaking. It cannot contain. The joy is too much. Let it break. That's why I am here for. That's why you have come to me. Let it break. Let it go into pieces. Out of joy, let it explode. Let it disappear into infinity. The sixth question, why am I always afraid of others' opinion? Because you are not. Because you are not yet. You are nothing but a piled up phenomenon of others' opinion. Who you are? Somebody says you are beautiful, so you are beautiful. And somebody says you are ugly, so you are ugly. And somebody says you are wonderful, so you are wonderful. And somebody says, I have never seen such a nasty person, so you are a nasty person. And people go on saying, and you go on collecting all these things. And that's your image. That's why your image is very contradictory, ambiguous. One person says you are beautiful, another says you are ugly. You want to forget this person's idea that you are ugly, but you cannot forget. It will be there. If you keep the opinion that you are beautiful, you will have to keep the opinion that you are ugly too. Your image is very ambiguous. You don't know exactly who you are. You are hodgepodge. What we call in India, you are khichdi. A mixture of so many things. You don't have a soul yet. You don't have any individuality. You don't have any integrated center. You are just a junkyard of others' opinions. That's why you are afraid, because if others' opinion change. You are in the grip of their hands. And this is the trick society has rules through this trick over you. The society has a technique. It makes you very much ambitious about social respect. Through it, it manipulates you. If you follow the rules of the society, it respects you. If you don't follow the rules of the society, it insults you tremendously. Very badly it hurts you. And to follow the rules of the society is to become a slave. Yes, it pays you great respect for being a slave. But if you want to be a free man, the society becomes angry. It does not want to do anything with you. To be really a free man and to exist in any society is very difficult. And I say it to you from my own experience, it is almost impossible to exist. Because the society does not want any free man. The free man is a danger for the society's existence. The society likes zombies, machines, robots, just always ready to fall anywhere in a queue. Just call them loudly, attention, and they start falling in line, just mechanically. They don't ask why. They are imitators. Now the society pays them well. It gives them respect. It gives them prizes, awards, honors. It has to. This is the trick. Those who are free, it never pays them any award. It never honors them. How it can honor them? They are enemies. A free man is an enemy in an unfree society. A moral man is an enemy in an immoral society. A religious man is an enemy in an irreligious society. In a world of materialists, a spiritual man is always in a difficulty. He does not fit anywhere. To fit with others, the society gives you as much as you want. It gives you a good image. It buttresses you. But if you don't listen, then it starts changing its opinion. Within seconds, it can demolish you. Because your image is in the social hands. So the first thing to be understood is, you ask, why am I always afraid of others' opinion? Because you are not yet. You are nothing but others' opinion. Hence the fear. They can take their opinion back. The priest has said that you are a very good man. Now, if you behave, you will remain a good man. If you don't behave according to him, and he may be himself a neurotic, but you have to behave according to him. If you don't behave, if you do something on your own, the priest will look at you and will say, now you are going against morality. You are going against religion. You are going against tradition. You are falling in sin. He will change his opinion. And you were good because of his opinion. Be yourself. Nobody can make you good and nobody can make you bad. Accept yourself. Nobody can make you good and nobody can make you bad. These false images are just living in dreams. A man was told by his doctor, "You are going to make medical history, man. You are the only male ever recorded who has become pregnant." The man replied, "This is terrible. Whatever will the neighbors say? I am not even married." Now he is not interested in the history and making a medical record. He is worried what the neighbors will say because he is not even married. We are continuously afraid. This fear will continue if you don't drop collecting opinions. You drop them. All opinions. Somebody believes that you are a saint, drop it, because he is dangerous. He will manipulate you through his idea. Once you listen to him and you believe him, he becomes the master and you become the slave. Sometimes people come to me and they say, "You are a great saint." I say, "Sorry, excuse me. Never utter such a word to me, because I am not going to be manipulated by anybody. I am just myself, saint or sinner. That doesn't matter." The man was thinking that he is trying to praise me. Maybe he is not even aware what he is doing. Whenever you praise a person, you become powerful. Whenever you praise a person and he accepts your praise, he has fallen a victim. Now you will control him. Now whenever he wants to do something, any innocent thing, just think, you call a certain man a saint, a mahatma, a great sage. Now one day he wants to smoke. What to do? He cannot smoke. Because what will happen to his sainthood? Now it seems too much to pay with sainthood just for a smoke. He cannot smoke because so many people call him a saint. Or he will become a hypocrite. He may start smoking behind the doors and he will not say that he smokes. And he will condemn smoking like anything. When he is in public, then he will have two faces, the public and the private. Then he will be split. Never accept others' opinions, good or bad. Just tell them, "Sorry, you please keep your opinion to yourself. I am myself." If you can remain that alert, nobody will ever be able to manipulate you. You will remain free. And freedom is joy. Freedom is difficult, remember, because society consists of slaves. Freedom is difficult, but freedom is the only joy there is. Freedom is the only dance there is. And freedom is the only door towards God. A slave never reaches to God. Cannot. The sixth question. Bhagwan, it has been said that the English make the best servants in the world. When you gave me my name, you translated it as "in service of love." I know now that it can also be translated as "the servant of love." I have wondered about this. Sometimes it seems that I am most in service of love when I am most myself and not intending to serve. Otherwise it seems more like subservience, and that I am suffering from the English cultural disease of politeness, servility and helpfulness. Will you please comment? The question is from Ma Premdasi. Premdasi actually means the servant of love. But while giving sannyas to her, I had translated it in service of love knowingly. Exact translation is the servant of love. I translated it in service of love for a certain reason. I would like you to become more and more serving, but I would not like you to become servants. Servants don't serve, only masters serve. Servants do their duty. Duty is a four-letter ugly word. They have to. There is no beauty in it. There is no joy in it. So be in service, but never be a servant. One thing. Second thing, when you become a servant, you learn habits. Service is an ongoing process. To become a servant is to attain to a character, a dead character. People know you are a public servant. People know that that man is a servant. A man in service is totally different. He is not predictable. Each moment he will choose to respond. You cannot depend on him, on his past. That's why I translated in service of love. Service is beautiful, but to become a servant is not good. Service is spontaneous. For example, you are passing from a road and you find a house is on fire and you rush into it and you save a child who was going to die. But you don't have to do it. You were not in search of some public service. You were just going for a morning walk and the house is on fire. You were not thinking about it at all, just the situation and the response. You are in service. But a servant is dangerous. Because if he cannot find somebody to serve, he will force somebody to be served. I have heard about a Christian missionary who was teaching his students, the Sunday students, small boys and girls. He was telling them, at least once a week do one good thing, one good work. Next Sunday, he inquired, have they done any good job? Have they done any public service? Have they been of some help to somebody? And three boys stood up. And he was very happy, out of 30 at this three. But that too is a great percentage. Who listens? So he asked the first boy, what you did, tell the whole class. And he said, sir, I helped an old woman to cross the road. He said, very good. Always take care of old women. And then he asked the other, and the other said, I also helped an old woman to cross the street. Then the priest was a little puzzled. But he said, nothing to be puzzled. There are so many old women. Maybe he also got one woman. So he asked the third, and the third says, I also helped an old woman to pass the street. Then the priest said, but this seems too much. You all got three old women? They said, no, there were not three, there were one. Only one woman was there. We all three helped. So he said, but three were needed? He said, you are saying three were needed? Even six, it would have been difficult, because he didn't want to go to the other side. It was very difficult, sir. But we did it. Something was to be done. She was very angry. Never be a servant, otherwise you will be in search. And if you cannot find some place to serve, you will be very angry. These people are there all over the world. The public servants. They are the most mischievous people. They create much mischief. Because when people don't want to be served, then too, they force their service. They have to force. They have an investment there. They cannot allow a beautiful world to exist. What will happen to them? Just think, no lepers left, no ill people left, no hospitals needed, and all have become enlightened, no schools, no college, and no universities needed. What will happen to public servants? They will start committing suicide. Nobody to serve. They need. They will manage somehow to create the situation where they can be of service. Their whole prestige depends on it. It is an ego trip. That's why, knowing well, I remember exactly well when I gave sannyas to Premdasi. I was just going to translate it as the servant of love, then I thought it is wrong. The word means that. I turned it and I told her, in service of love. Be in service. But don't make service your character. I love people who live characterlessly, who live moment to moment, who just respond to situations. Otherwise, you will be in a bondage. And you are right, Premdasi. You say, I am most in service of love when I am most myself and not intending to serve. Perfectly true. It's how it is. When you intend to serve, it is no more beautiful. It is no more love. When you are yourself, utterly yourself, out of that independence, out of that being, arises a love. And you serve people. And there is no feeling that you are a servant and they are masters. You simply serve because you have too much to give. You have to share. You flow in your sharing, in your love, in your compassion. The last question. Can prayer be sometimes harmful? Never heard. Except in one case. This is the story. Two girls married on the same day and took their new husbands to the same honeymoon hotel. The four of them sat in the lounge, thinking how obvious it would look if they all went to bed at the same early hour. But after a while it was decided that the girls should go out in the direction of the ladies and then slip up to their rooms. and the man would have a last drink at the bar. After about 10 or 15 minutes, the man would leave casually in the same manner and join the brides. However, just as they were about to follow the girls, every light in the place failed, which was disconcerting in a strange building. Nevertheless, each was convinced he could find his room, and so they set off. Harry groped up stairs and along passages, counting doors in his careful way, for he was a very careful man, and found the room. Just to make sure, he struck a match and saw bits of confetti on the landing. Then quietly entering, he carefully took off his clothes, put on his pajamas, kneeled down and said his prayers, climbed into bed and was just going to make love. And at that very moment all the lights came on, and he saw that he was in the right room, as it were, but on the wrong floor. And this was the other man's bride. He grabbed his clothes and hurried off to his own proper room, only to find that the other man was an atheist. Enough for today.